This spoiler-filled podcast is recorded live, unscripted, and intended for those over 18. Now prepare your ears for the audio stimulation they've been waiting for all day as we step into
the spoiler room.
And here we are live on another spoiler room. It is our second Big 4-0 special where we're covering films from 1976 that were voted on by folks like you. And we picked the top 17, and that's what we're covering this year. And today, number two, we are looking at the John Carpenter classic, Assault on Precinct 13. Yes, from 1976. And I've got a great crew assembled tonight to talk about this interesting action thriller. First off in the room, you recognize his voice for sure, regular in the spoiler room. He's been whittling away on the editing machine for so long, but he's taking a break to help talk about this film. Cole, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing fantastic, man. Thanks for having me, Mark.
Are you recovered yet from all your editing, or are you still editing?
It will literally be done tomorrow. I know I've been saying that, but there's no, I realized I figured out the grain remover tool in After Effects, and
sure.
Nice.
Well, I won't eat up all of your time, but there's about four scenes where I decided to do grain in camera.
Oh,
and
for
up-and-coming filmmakers, if you want to add a grain effect, just get a program, because if you mess with your ISO settings, you're going to have a grain that's assaulting to the eyes. But anyways, back to the show.
Sure. Well, we're glad to have you on. And next to him, we've got returning to the spoiler room. He hasn't been here for a while. Please welcome the one and only Mr. Gabe from Stuffed Burrito Entertainment. How you doing tonight, Gabe?
How you doing? Anybody got a smoke?
No, man, those things will kill you.
I'm good, guys. Good, happy to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you back, Gabe. And next to him is the BFD himself. He doesn't sit in chairs like he used to, but he's still the big freaking deal, Mr. Glenn Bittner. Hello, sir.
Hello.
And how are you tonight?
Black. to which you should respond
for the last 30 years of my life. And that laugh, you hear it. He is here. The one and only Mr. Scotty D has joined us in the spoiler room to talk about Assault on Precinct 13. Hello, Scott.
Hey, I don't have a line from this movie ready, so I'll go further back to its inspiration and let's make a little noise, Colorado.
Yes, folks, we are talking Assault on Precinct 13, John Carpenter's second full-length feature, which he did right after Dark Star, which I will not comment on because many people like that film, but we will not go there. That's for another time. But here on Assault on Precinct 13, according to the mighty IMDb, it describes the isolated inhabitants of an abandoned police station are under attack by the overwhelming number of a seemingly unstoppable street gang, which actually that's a pretty accurate description, I think, for IMDb. So kudos to whoever wrote that. That pretty well sums up the very basic, but there's a number of other things going on with this film and what makes it a classic and what makes me glad that it was voted on so we can talk about it tonight. We're going to get some people's just initial reactions with when they first saw Assault on Precinct 13. We'll start with you, Gabe, since you haven't been here for a while. What were your thoughts when you first saw this film?
Well, I can't lie and I'm ashamed to admit it, but I discovered this movie due to its remake. I was a John Carpenter fan for the longest time, but this is one of those movies that came before my time, so I didn't really know about it until I saw the, I think it was 2005, the one with Ethan Hawke.
Yep.
I discovered that it was a remake, so that's the one good thing I will give remakes. If you're a film lover, you look at a remake, you feel compelled to go back and see what inspired that remake. And that's how I discovered this movie. So I rented it from Netflix about 6 years ago, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched it, and I'm like, wow, this movie is badass. I mean, this is just a really well-made thriller. And I was actually surprised, considering the fact that it came from 1976, how progressive it was. Mm. You know, you have a black lead who is not some stereotypical character. He's just, you know, he's a man doing his job, trying to protect people, trying to stay alive. And you have, I like the criminal in this movie. I like him because he's so, like, cool and witty and, like, definitely threatening, but in a way where you don't mess with him, he won't mess with you. I just, well, one thing for sure, anytime you watch a John Carpenter movie, you know you're going to get an awesome score that he did himself. So, you know, mm-hmm. as soon as I put the movie on, I knew I was watching a John Carpenter movie. yeah. And yeah, I just remember really enjoying it. I did like the remake, mm-hmm. but the original is just far more intense. And the remake obviously tries to go on a bigger scale, give you more action, more characters. This is just a really simple thriller that's so effective. That it doesn't matter how old it is, it's just a good example of what a good action thriller is supposed to do.
Yeah, I agree. It definitely stands the test of time better than some other films of that age. Glenn, how about you, sir? When you first saw this film, did you watch it after you heard about the hype, or how did you see it?
Oh, man. When I first saw this one, I don't know. I've seen it numerous times. Probably the last time I remember seeing it was probably in college, so about 20-some years ago. I know I saw it before that because I had it on videotape. I had taped it off of something. But I remember watching it, and I get this feeling every time I rewatch it, is there's a part of me where I like that. I think it's a fun movie, but at times I almost wonder if it's supposed to be part comedy, because some of the scenes, when the bad guys like first open fire, and that goes on for what feels like forever, with just bullets and window break, window break, window break, and then it's like done, and then a few more bullets, and then it's done, and then one more bullet, and then it's done, and then one more bullet. So, For when it was made, I mean, obviously, if this was made today, people would think it was insanely boring.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the way the action scenes play out, it's not modern action scenes. But for the time it was made, this was a pretty gritty film.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty substantial body count for a film from 1976.
There is definitely a body count, and we're going to talk about a couple of those bodies that end up dropping, but...
A little twist.
Yes, definitely. So we'll move here. Scott, how about you, sir, when you first saw this film?
Well, I won't get into like the specific like plot points right now because I think we're going to do that in a bit.
Yes, we will.
But I first discovered this movie when I was in college. I was a big fan of Carpenter already. I was a fan of Carpenter like ever since I was able to watch any of his movies. So of course I start out with like Starman, and then I'm eventually allowed to watch the harder stuff. And I remember it was a blind buy. I used to rent a lot of movies instead of going to class. And then when I wasn't renting a lot of movies instead of going to class, I was buying a lot of movies. And I used to actually, before we had DVDs and Blu-rays that gave you proper aspect ratios and stuff, they actually had marketed special edition letterboxed VHS tapes. And so I actually bought what I think was some sort of an anniversary edition. I don't know if it was supposed to be, I want to say maybe a 20th anniversary edition or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Assault on Precinct 13. It was like $15 for a VHS that had a little bit of like interviews and stuff tacked at the end. And the movie was letterboxed. I'm like, fuck yeah, Carpenter. And it was one of the few Carpenter films I had not seen. And of course, you know, you plug that sucker in, and you, just like Gabe said, I mean, that music starts, and you just know that you're seeing a Carpenter movie. He's absolutely right. And yeah, this thing plays out really, really intensely. It was just, what always gets me about this, I see this every few years, this movie, and what always gets me is how, if I checked the clock this last time I was watching it, the main event that triggers everything that's going on doesn't happen until 32 minutes into the movie, and the big actual assault on the station doesn't happen till about like 40 minutes into the movie. I wouldn't have known that, because every time I watch it, I just am like taken by how fast this movie seems to go, even though everything doesn't really seem like everything kind of goes against that. There's a long setup, and as Glenn said, yeah, the action is not like a standard movie. In fact, it's lots of like sudden action and then a long pause, and sudden action and a long pause. I mean, it's this film breaks. I mean, I don't know if John Carpenter. I think he was setting up to redo a version of Rio Bravo, which he sort of did, but not really. So he was trying to do like a traditional like Howard Hawks type movie. I don't think he realized how many rules he was breaking when he made this movie, but he broke the rules, and it works anyway.
it does work, yeah. And we'll get into that, especially with our discussion. What I want to initially talk about is the characters, but let's get Cole's reaction quick. When you first saw this film, sir, how'd you feel about it? Did you feel it was overhyped? Had you heard about it before you watched it?
Well, I'm a huge John Carpenter fan, and that sounds redundant, especially with all the people here tonight who I'm sure are John Carpenter fans as well. Mm-hmm. But going back to the Betamax days, you know, watching The Thing and Halloween especially, and I saw this film probably in 99, 2000. I saw it later. Rented it on VHS when I was out of high school and kind of, you know, had a job and was able to start, you know, buying and renting movies and checking out all this shit. And this is, you know, John Carpenter. I mean, this is his movie. Lots of people, when they think of John Carpenter, well, some people at least may think of, you know, Butcher Knives and shit, but really when I think of John Carpenter, I think of the two unlikely heroes at the end of the movie, armed to the teeth, filled with a sense of bravado and self-righteousness and integrity, walking into a fiery, uncertain fate. And he does this in The Thing, he does it in Vampires, he does it in Ghosts of Mars, and a few others I'm not thinking of. I mean, that is the John Carpenter ending, and it's totally satisfying. Sometimes I will sit and watch, like, Ghosts of Mars or Vampires or Assault on Precinct 13 and just anticipate the ending. Just anticipate his score and those two characters kind of patting each other on the back. And in the case of Ghosts of Mars, Ice Cube looks right at the fucking camera.
Yes! Thank you!
So in terms of this film, I mean, it was the first of... I mean, that's, you know, John Carpenter is... He's a Western director. He's, you know, he's a horror director too, but, you know, Westerns are in his bones, in so much as horror is in my bones. Westerns are in his bones, and mm-hmm. no matter what he does, you know, it's always his Western roots are always going to shine through. I think this is a great action movie. I think the pivotal moment is even more poignant for me because I know that, you know, he was supposed to cut that out and, in fact, illegally told them that he had cut it and just sent the prints to the theaters and said, you know, it's been cut. No, nothing was cut. He didn't cut a second. You know, that's Carpenter, man. That's Carpenter, folks. He's badass. People want to pigeonhole him as some sexist or, you know, whatever. Carpenter is the man. He is a genius in his own right. He's not on the level of, you know, he doesn't have the following Kubrick has, I guess, in the sense that, you know, he doesn't have a 200 IQ. I don't know what, you know, Carpenter's IQ is, but he is extremely nuanced and sophisticated in terms of how he tells a story. And this is a prime example of that, for sure.
Oh, yeah, especially for it being his second feature. You know, the first one was Dark Star, which was more of a parody of sorts of 2001. And then you follow that up with this one, and this was just before Halloween was this film, I believe, where they came out. Yeah, because this was, well, this was released in November of 76, so.
Yeah, but 2 years apart. So.
Yeah, so this was just before his Halloween, but yeah, I loved this film too. And watching it again, I got the Laserdisc, but watching it again, it just blew my mind that it's out of, you know, that's why I wanted to do these 1976 films. This is really one of those that still is poignant today and I think still works. And it's John Carpenter, so you got some great blue-collared characters in here, I think. But not, you know, they're still not your traditional characters, but they're still kind of supposedly the down-to-earth type characters that he has. But you mentioned it, someone mentioned it, I think Gabe mentioned it, was how you have a strong minority lead in here, a minority person as the lead, Ethan Bishop. Not only that, I mean, he's not only the lead, but he's in a position of authority in this film, right, Glenn? What'd you think of the Ethan Bishop character? Well, just about any of the characters in here, but especially Ethan Bishop. Did you think that kind of was interesting to have, considering when this film came out?
Possibly. I mean, I don't know. It's not like it's unheard of, and I think it's, I don't know. If it was cast today, I would think it would have been probably a very intentional casting. I don't know if it was an intentional casting when he did it, because I don't know how much, you know, this was supposed to be like kind of an idea of you know, like race relations and stuff like that, because they made a point of mentioning that the gang was like multicultural, you know. It's like the United Colors of Benetton gang. But yeah. I think it wasn't. I don't know. I don't know if it was an intentional casting to go with him as like the lead and everything, and you know, the guy of authority. As I said, if you cast it today, I think it'd be a statement saying, you know, trying to play the whole thing off. It's, yeah, there's all these gang guys who are horrible, but here's a black man who's a good guy, because some directors try to do that to, you know, get away from the you know, 80 plus years of Hollywood saying black people are servants and criminals.
Yeah,
that's what they're allowed to do. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, if it was an intentional casting, I mean, kudos for doing it in 1976.
Right. It could be also. I mean, this is a budget of $150,000. Yes, you heard that right, folks. $150,000. This entire film was shot on, and so it could have been just simply who he could get, because after all, who's it? Darwin Johnston, who's Napoleon. Wilson, who's the crook, if you will, the one of the really supposed bad guys. You know, he's a guy going to death row, basically. He's a killer, and he ends up partnering up with Ethan because they're trapped in the same building together, being sieged by these gangs. That guy, though, Darwin Johnston, apparently was Carpenter's next-door neighbor. according to some details, and actually he shows up later in The Fog of John Carpenter's, but he was also in Eraserhead.
And that's so wild, though, because he's, you know, Austin Stoker, who plays the Bishop character, and God, was this guy incredible in this movie. He was just excellent. He had a decent career. I was amazed by the people he was able to get on the flip side of that, because, you know, while Austin Stoker certainly wasn't a big name or anything, he had been in like a number of big movies. He had done a lot of TV. He was on the Planet of the Apes TV series, as well as the last movie and everything. And even the people he said that he got from Central Casting, I was just thinking, like, what was that person doing in Central Casting? The first cop that gets killed, if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong, but I heard him mention, so I'm like, what? The first cop who gets killed in this movie is the guy who played the bad guy in The Searchers. The best movie ever made. Holy crap. What was that guy doing in Central Casting? It was just incredible. So, I mean, But, you know, that's something that he's always been able to do, is Carpenter has always had a really good eye for getting people that you – that either they seem to be, like, people that he, like, plucks at random and he just has a really good eye for talent, or they're people that you wouldn't expect. Like, for instance, when – he cast Kurt Russell in Elvis and then The Escape from New York and then The Thing, completely going against what his type, which, you know, 5 years before that was like Disney's golden child. You know, I mean, and, you know, does anybody look at, I mean, Kurt Russell's done films for Disney within the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. But does anybody look at Kurt Russell and think of him as Disney's golden child anymore? No. Well, it's amazing what he can do.
Yeah, it is. It is. No, it's okay. It is amazing what he can do. And so you've got veteran actor Austin Stoker next to Darwin Johnston, who hadn't done much in this, but he's the charismatic bad guy. You can't help but like this guy, can you, Gabe? When you first meet Napoleon.
he's whatever he did to get to where he's headed.
Yeah.
You know, they don't show you and they don't really discuss it, but I'm almost intrigued. I would almost want to see a prequel to this movie just to see the rise of Napoleon, I guess. But it's almost like he kind of has made peace with himself. Mm-hmm. You know, like maybe he was just a really violent criminal, but now he's just kind of like, okay, well, I got caught. I'm going to die in prison, so, oh, well. But then he kind of, like, has this chance for redemption, which I always find to be a very cool concept for any character that is a criminal and is put in a situation where they can either cut and run, save themselves, or, you know, they can help fight off a horde of gang members. But that's what I like about the character, is the fact that he... This is the 70s, you know? Yeah. This is... racial tension is still high. Mm-hmm. And your average... Well, I shouldn't say your average, but... He looks like the kind of guy, almost like a redneck character, that would never trust a black man. Mm-hmm. That would just hate the world, but yet he's going into a situation with this minority that's in an authority position, and he says, you know what, my situation here is fucked, so I don't care what color this guy is, I don't care if there's a chick who happens to be kind of hot, but yeah, we'll get to that later, I don't care what's going on, I'm gonna fight some freaking bad guys, you know, and maybe I'll redeem myself a little bit. So you can't help but like him, because whatever he did in his past, and that's also another interesting concept. What if this guy murdered his mother? We don't know. But yet he's so cool in the movie, he's, in a way he's kind of heroic, that I don't care who he killed. I like him. I like him now. And I love that ending. Like, it will be an honor if you walk out with me. It's like, you don't know what this guy has done, but okay, you know. But yeah, I like the character, and I love how he's. I love that line, you know.
Yeah.
And he got a smoke. You know?
Yes.
He's a really cool character. I really enjoy him.
Yeah, I love the mystery of him too. You know, it shows you the filmmaking technique of 76 and today, and maybe it was limited budget, but we never get really any answers of why this guy's going to death row. All we know is they've alluded to the fact he killed a lot of people at some point, a lot of men. We don't know exactly why, nor do we know why he's called Napoleon, though he teases that he'll tell us just at the moment of his death, though that never happened, so we never actually find out. But he's played so charismatically. I just love that, and the dynamic between him and the Bishop character. But we can't forget the strong female character that shows up in this film, that when you first meet her, I don't think you expect that from the Lee character, Laurie Zimmer. Cole, what'd you think of the female character in here, Lee?
Fantastic, man. Fantastic. And you saw the remake try for it and fumble with it. And again, I, you know, not to diss the remake. I actually am, being a huge Ethan Hawke fan, I find it entirely watchable. But it just goes to show you, Carpenter gets this rep as a sexist. It stands out in a few things. I remember Ebert's review for Vampires, you know, and accused Carpenter of only hiring big-breasted women, which is so bizarre, you know. And it's not just Ebert. I'm just thinking
that's because he shoots in widescreen, so of course he's going to get big-breasted women.
They got to fit him. Panavision lenses, they got to fit.
Yeah, man, no, I love the character. I don't have anything super sophisticated to say about her. I do love the character. I love Carpenter's approach to all his characters, which is to just be as honest as he can with his self, you know. Yeah. You guys are talking about the lead villain, you know, it doesn't really matter what he did if you know the filmmaker, you know, which shouldn't be a prerequisite for watching the movie. You know, you shouldn't need a cheat sheet, but really, you probably know this is a Snake Plissken-esque type of guy who is really, you know, like a Neo, you know, to put it into modern terms, like a Morpheus type of guy who, yeah, you know, is fighting the good fight and probably murdering a lot of his adversaries along the way. Sure. But no, the female character is the character you mentioned is great. I think all the characters are great. Well developed for such a, it seems short. What is this, like 80 minutes?
Yeah, it's like 78.
No.
It's an hour. It's 73 minutes.
No. This movie.
Oh, I'm sorry. 91
minutes. It's an hour. Yeah, it's an hour and 31 minutes, which is not a long movie. I mean, it's a short, it's like a little B-movie length, but it's still, it feels quicker, doesn't it?
Man, it seems like it smokes.
Well,
yeah.
I think that goes along with what you're saying, Cole, with his characters. I just, for me to weigh in on the Lee character, she was actually the surprise when I first watched this. And even now, watching the Laserdisc, it's amazing how he handles this material versus other films who have tried, because they hint at a little bit of an attraction maybe between her and the Napoleon character,
yeah.
But it's not taken to the intimacy level or whatever. It's a little bit there, but you know, then things get all fiery and she shows she can hold her own with these two guys. You know, she's blowing guys away with her six-shooter down the hallway. She's not hesitating. In fact, she gets hit in the arm, and she just stands there like, fuck you.
Yeah. You know, that is one of the touches. He says he wanted to remake Rio Bravo, which he kind of did, and then he kind of kept remaking Rio Bravo Forever and stuff, which is like what he, because it's a great movie.
Yeah.
This really is one of the Howard Hawks touches that he puts in the movie, is that Howard Hawks tended to put some very strong women in his movies at a time when that was not fashionable. Mm-hmm. And you can look at Lauren Bacall in To Have and Have Not.
Mm-hmm.
And also Angie Dickinson in Rio Bravo, and yeah, they have a romantic relationship and everything like that, but these aren't any like shrinking violet women. They are tough. They are often tougher than the good guys, and they teach the good guys how to be like tougher than what they would normally be. So that is definitely a Hawksism, I think, that he put in. If you couldn't tell, I rewatched Rio Bravo if you weren't watching this again, because fuck, it's so good.
Well, and the lady who played, the actress who played Lee, this was her first acting role, according to IMDb anyway, Laurie Zimmer. And you couldn't, watch the way she acts, you couldn't tell. You know, and for me, I guess this time around, for me, her character really stood out for me as going, wow, you know, here people have complained about, you know, lack of strong female characters, and here in 76, Carpenter's got one right there in the camera. Takes a shot in the arm, doesn't even flinch.
But no. He did that so often, and he did get called on it a lot, and I don't understand it, because he had her in this movie. You have Jamie Lee, of course, in Halloween. Everybody knows that one. A movie that gets overlooked is a TV movie he did called Someone's Watching Me. Adrienne Barbeau is fantastic in that movie and plays a character who is just matter-of-factly a lesbian in like a time when that was never even touched upon. Barbeau again in The Fog, and then you've got all the other great, you know, things through the 80s and 90s where you say, like, you know, these women in this movie, they hold their own. They are independent people, you know, and they're all the way up to, like, Ghosts of Mars, where, I mean, Natasha Henstridge, you know, people hate on that movie a lot, and I know there's a lot of people who don't like it.
I like it.
She kicks ass in that movie.
She stood out for me in this. What also stood out, and Glenn, I want to get your thought real quick on this, is how he introduces characters, and then we get to learn a little bit about them, but he offs some of them at random points. I mean, wouldn't you say, does that surprise you at all a little bit, to where we actually develop some of these characters and then they get killed, like the Stoker character who's escorting our criminals in the bus.
First, when I saw him, I'm like, oh my god, it's like they went 25 years in the future from now, got an aging Mark Wahlberg and took him back to be in this movie. But yeah, it's like they show, like, development, like he's going to go somewhere, like he's going to have something to do, and pretty much all he does is he's one of the most inept prisoner transporters ever. It's like, you know, like when he, like, contacts, like, Precinct 13, he's like, yeah, I got a guy with a tummy ache here. We need to stop and put him in jail. Well, this precinct's closed. You have to go 10 blocks. I don't have time for that. 10 blocks? God, I have a man who might poop himself. I mean, but yeah, it's. I love how they kind of, like, develop him, and it's like, as soon as, like, the stuff happens, it's like, get on the bus, and dead.
Well, yeah. And then you think there might be something a little more. Okay, is the guy sick? Is he faking it? Did he get ill on purpose? And no, he gets dead, too.
And dead. Yep.
You know, or even the who's it, the character or whatnot in there, who's there with Lee when we first meet them, and dad.
Well, it's like the movie almost sets it up like the fact that, yeah, like, that guy's faking being sick, mm-hmm. and, like, this whole assault is like some kind of actual trick to try to, like, bust out Napoleon or something. It's kind of like where it's like leading to, like, that kind of thing a little bit. In some ways you might be led that way. Because, yeah, this guy happens to get sick when they get by this precinct that's closing down, and, you know, and this gang is just going to happen to be there. But, of course, that's not how it goes. But, yeah, it's like Carpenter sets up these little things and then just says, no. And whether it's he just puts him in there just because of some depth to some otherwise cardboard cutout people, or that he just likes fucking with us.
I think it's a little bit of both, actually, with this film. And that's, you even get that with your gang members, don't you, Cole? With our gang member, the white-haired gang member with the sniper rifle, and you think he's going to be, okay, he's the head villain guy, and how does he get offed? By a revengeful dad with a revolver. What'd you think about that, how they built that guy up, and then and how he met his demise?
Well, yeah, I mean, the whole film is kind of cased that way, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It offsets itself, kind of ties into what Glenn was saying, like, as it moves along, and Glenn was even talking about the pacing of the bullets, you know, and how he was wondering if it might be comedic. And I'm sure it is. I'm sure when Carpenter and his editors or whoever, I'm sure, you know, when they're up at 3 a.m, you know, losing their minds, trying to splice all this together, it gets to the point where, you know, they just have fun. You know, mm-hmm. they start messing with audience expectations. And again, part of the reason probably the death of the little girl is still in the film was just they were working so hard. If you know, if the powers that be had had their way, this movie probably wouldn't be talking about it all of these years later, what, 40 years later, if that shot with the girl being murdered wasn't in the film. I mean, really? What? I don't know. I don't know that we would be discussing this. Anyways, to go back to your comment about the gangster, yeah, man, I think a lot of the deaths in this movie are surprising. I think at the time, again, when I watched this, I was already a Carpenter fan. I think I'd already even seen Vampires, so I kind of knew what to expect. But I can imagine watching this back in 76, especially to your audience who hadn't seen Westerns or hadn't seen Rio Bravo. You know, seeing these two characters, nothing is going to be good for either of them, most likely. But you know, they're friends, they're buddies. You know, it's life during the wartime, and you see that in Carpenter when he's interviewed. The sense of war, the sense of, you know, fuck it, it's me against the whole world. You know, it's like attitude, man. And I think that leads to a lot of his choices, and I see that. I see his influences everywhere. I see it in Hateful Eight all over, and as long as we're talking about killing, you know, important characters, I see that completely in Hateful Eight. You know, the death of Kurt Russell, you know, why not kill your best character right away? You know, that's Carpenter. I mean, I totally see that all over the place. Mm-hmm. Totally. I think it's great. I think it just ties into Carpenter's sense of timing and, you know, his middle finger right at the audience, his middle finger, the Roddy Rowdy Piper middle finger at the end of They Live, you know?
Yes. Well, and that's what's interesting is we've talked about the pacing, the amount of characters you're introduced and you learn about and then they're gone, but you learn the way it's crafted, you learn enough of them to where you care or you want to see what happens to him next, especially the little girl, which is actually out of left field what really triggers all the events on Assault on Precinct 13. We're introduced to the dad and the little girl, and the scene seems kind of random at first. And you're like, okay, where's this going? Where's this? Oh, okay, well, they're in a dangerous neighborhood. They're going to be this. And then we get the ice cream scene, folks. And yes, this is spoiler room. She goes to get ice cream, and the bad guy, who we mentioned just earlier, gets offed in a field by a guy with a revolver, not by our heroes at all. Our bad guy shoots the little girl when she goes back because she got the wrong ice cream. I mean, the fact you've built this guy up to be badass. He just shot a kid, and the kid actually dies on screen. Gabe, I mean, even nowadays, you don't see that often, do you?
No. Half the time, you'll see the gun go off, and then you might see the dead body on the floor, or, you know, there's always a cutaway, there's always something. I want to add that these gang members are actually scary in a way, and I heard comparisons that, of course, Rio Bravo inspired this movie, but also a little bit of Night of the Living Dead, because you get just a horde of gang members who never say anything. It's almost like they're almost zombie-like, you know, and they set it up that they're not afraid to die, so they just kind of charge in there, like, not giving a shit. So here's this guy who never says a word. He's aiming at random people, ready to you know, shoot anybody, and then he just offs this little girl who is obviously in the wrong place at the wrong time. And yeah, they show it. They actually show it. And that scene, the studios and everybody wanted that scene cut. And it may seem like a senseless thing to do in the film, but like you say, it actually sets the whole events in motion. Everything is brought into play because of this vengeful father who saw his daughter get killed. But the fact that they show it, and then the response, the look on her face, it's so genuine. Like, look, her line delivery sucked, but that freaking reaction was award-worthy. Because I'm like, wow. I mean, and you know what? And they go as far as to splatter fake blood all over her chest.
Mm-hmm.
That's deep. I mean, this movie has way more balls than half the movies that are made nowadays to show a little girl, a little innocent girl who all she wanted was ice cream, but the right kind of ice cream. And she gets killed in front of us to the point where, you know, we want to see this dad get his revenge. And right. I want to add also, you know, you guys were talking about how this movie just goes against type. It goes against every convention of most movies. The way it ends, our main characters never even know why they just went through this. The dad is like, he can't talk, he's in shock, he gets wheeled away, he mouths off, thank you, but, you know, they're probably sitting there like, you're welcome, but why the fuck did we just nearly die because of you?
I also think it's, well, I think it's also a thing, you know, and they even comment, we don't know who this guy is, you know, what he's doing here. It's basically the idea of right or wrong. Does it matter?
Mm-hmm.
Does it matter why he came in here, you know, desperate and looking for help?
That's
why. Yeah. And that's why. And and the thing event that does trigger it off is so shocking. I mean, I remember when I was first watching it in my college dorm room. I mean, I couldn't believe what I just saw. And that is not. I mean, he couldn't have set that. He could barely set that off to tug at your heartstrings anymore. They put this little girl in pigtails, and you know what little girl that was? That was Kim Richards. That was the Witch Mountain girl. The year before, she was in Escape from Witch Mountain. I mean, for God's sake, they put the Witch Mountain girl in pigtails, set her off for ice cream, and had her get shot. Yes. I mean, and what it is, was it? It was so random. The guy barely looks at her. It's so random.
Yeah.
Senseless and cruel and just senseless, which, I mean, when we hear about all these news reports on TV and everything, isn't that our response? Like, what was the sense of any of this? Why did this have to happen? I mean, that just, and it just sits on the Carpenter couldn't have done it. The only way he could have made it any worse is if he shot through a puppy instead of an ice cream. And then, like, that's the only way. And even then, I think that people would have like given up because it would have been overkill.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, it was just like, it is like the ultimate like encapsulation of the most senseless, you know, violence. Mm-hmm. And so yes, naturally this guy's upset. He does this thing which maybe he should have done, maybe he shouldn't have done. But they don't know that. What's the purpose of it? It doesn't matter, because once he enters that station, that's the idea. That's supposed to be your sanctuary. That's
right.
Supposed to be your hope.
Yeah, and that is I always love that they never find out. And that whole series of events just blew me away watching it a second time was, wow, here the main villain guy that we think is going to be a main villain probably throughout offs the daughter. Then the dad who gets the gun from the ice cream man who says, hey, I've got a gun under the dash. And he's like, oh, okay. So then you confront him and you're like, okay, he's confronting the big bad guy who just offed his daughter who gets out all cool with his sniper rifle. Okay, he's going to off the dad. Wait, no, he doesn't off the dad. The dad pops 3 or 4 caps in his ass. And then he goes running away. It's like, wait, what? You know? So I love that whole sequence. And, yeah, it is heartbreaking that they picked that actress. He had to pick the most adorable girl who has some has some adorable lines in the beginning. She's a prime example of how they set the character up enough so you either care or want to see what, you know, where they're going with it. And then you see where they are, and you're just like, holy crap. She was just being kind to her dad, and they were looking at getting their nanny out of the hood. And, yeah, now she's a permanent resident of the hood. Yeah. And then we alluded to it. It's Carpenter. Sorry. It's Carpenter. So he's a major threat in that he produces, directs. He edited under a different name in this film. He helped with the storyboarding, art direction. I mean, he did a lot of things in this film. But the music, you know that signature synth that Carpenter had, especially for his early stuff. But it's interesting how he used the music in this in that it's almost used similar to the way Jaws was. Anyone else notice that, though, how he used the music with the villains? Gabe, what about you?
Yeah, I noticed it because, yeah, I love the score and I love Carpenter's style of music, but it definitely, you know, it triggered my brain into thinking, oh, shit, something's going to happen. And there were times, and again, this is a now 40-year-old movie, and I don't do this. I don't do this with modern films, but there are times I was on the edge of my seat, and I was just, even though I had seen the movie, I was just waiting to see what exactly was going to happen. So I think the music does add a lot of suspense, and it definitely lets you know that something wicked this way comes.
Yeah, well, because I noticed that at first with the bad guys, I'm like, okay. And then when the bus shows up with our, you know, guys going to death row, suddenly he starts the music again. It's a little different. I'm like, oh, these are bad guys now. These aren't the, you know, the good guys. Now we have some music, and the good guys don't really get a theme. It seems like the bad guys are the only ones, or when bad things happen, are the only times when you get music. Did you get that impression, Cole, at all?
Honestly, I didn't notice that, but I
see. That's okay. I was just wondering.
But I will say about the music, man. I mean, shit, Carpenter scores. I mean, we gotta give him props. I mean, who else does this? Who else scores their movies nowadays? You know, does Spielberg score his movies? Does Adam Green score his movies? Who scores their own fucking movies? Nobody. It's so cool, and it gives his movies, it makes his movies what they are. I mean, really, his scores, and the movie, in the movies he didn't score for himself, it shows. Even the ones he had help with, like Shirley Walker helped with Escape from L.A., mm-hmm. Man, you know, it shows, you know, you can tell when somebody else steps in there and helps them, it becomes more of a Mickey Mousing type thing, you know what, sure. I mean? It becomes more where the score hits the beat of the actors as opposed to the score being a character, you know, it's mm-hmm. two totally different types of scoring. You know, it's, I know that, and this is a related note, I'm going to go off topic, but it is a related note. I know Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross have caught a lot of flack when they won the Oscar for Social Network because they're scoring like John Carpenter scored. Mm-hmm. They're scoring with the script in mind, scoring for the story, not right. scoring for the scene. Right. And I am all in support of that, baby. I really support that. I support the director having the score before he ever goes into the fucking editing room. I totally support that. I'm not saying it always needs to be done, but I've worked with composers who are like, I need your final cut. It's like, dude, you must be out of your mind. You're going to get my final cut, and then you're just going to, what, Mickey Mouse it, and then I'm going to release my movie? No. I need your music, and I think Carpenter was way ahead of the bell curve knowing that you needed an idea of what the music needed to say before you ever applied it to the film. And, even Danny Elfman wrote the score for Batman before he ever met with Tim Burton. I mean, you have to have an idea. So anyways, yeah, I'm a big fan of Carpenter's scores.
Plus that people now have, you know, basically, you know, they've unceremoniously dumped Carpenter from actually directing again. As Carpenter said, in Europe I'm a genius, and in the United States I'm a bum. He says something like that.
Yeah.
But you know how? But look at this. Now, what is he doing now? He's releasing his second album in like a couple years now.
Yeah.
He's going on tour. And how many people can you say that not only does he score his own films, he inspired his own genre of music? Because nowadays you'll hear about a kind of music we started talking about a little bit when we were talking about Turbo Kid last week, type of music called synthwave. And synthwave is basically supposed to sound like, well, it's supposed to sound like old, like 80s music. Yeah, listen to it. Does it sound like 80s music? No, it's every single bit of it, they sound like John Carpenter scores. Every single one. Which is actually part of the reason why I like it.
Yeah, the music plays a big part in Carpenter's films, and you can that really comes out here in Assault on Precinct 13, and he uses it effectively, I think more effectively than you might think, with it, you know. And yeah, I love his scores. I've got the score up to Big Trouble Little China, to They Live, and that, and you know, it's some great stuff there that he puts out. And you know, I think it's a little bit of control for him, because he wants to put out, he's got an exact vision of what he wants, and that's why I think partly he does so many roles, and that kind of, you know, makes some producers out there nervous, or some, you know, studios out there nervous that you've got the one guy doing everything, but you know you're getting his vision then, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
And with this film, from what I've read up on it, you know, he was just getting who he could. The art director apparently was a green guy that he took a chance on, and he put it right in the guy's lap and said, hey, you're the art director. You need to do this. Here you go. You know, I'll help where I can. And so apparently, you know, he did that with the guy, and the guy loved it. You know, he's like, really? You know, I mean, this is supposed to be a feature, you know, wide release film, and you want me to do what? Okay. You know, and what's interesting about Assault on Precinct 13, and we'll wrap it up here a little bit, but I found it interesting doing some research on it that it didn't sit well when it was first released in the U.S. Then it was released in England, and it was huge there, because it made sense to me, because I looked at it and going, you know, this does feel a little more like a European type of film type storytelling, and I could see why it might have been a bigger hit in England, and then it got a big hit in Europe when it made it across there, and then suddenly when it came back to the U.S., critics revisited it, and suddenly they were finding, you know, the art in it or whatnot. So I kind of found that interesting that Europe, you know, it suddenly really loved it, and all of a sudden U.S. critics were like, oh, well, you know what? Now that you mention it...
Isn't that way a lot, though, man? Like, so, Donnie Darko was that way. I mean, they seem to catch on to shit that's unique and cool way quicker.
Yeah.
You know, they have more of an adventurous sense of film going.
Oh well, yeah. I mean, like, you look at the French New Wave. I mean, French New Wave started as not a group of filmmakers; they started as a group of film critics in Cahiers du Cinéma. And what were they all? Were these people all talking about the great past French filmmakers? No, because guess what? There hardly were any. They were talking about the great American filmmakers, many of which had been overlooked, including Howard Hawks, John Ford, all these great people. And then suddenly, whoa, lo and behold, American critics start saying, boy, you know, these guys can really direct. Like, I wonder where these guys have been. I mean, I think people kind of really should always look to see, like, well, what are these guys talking about? Because sometimes what these guys are talking about, it's not going to translate. But sometimes I think what the other guys are talking about, usually they're on to something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man.
I definitely agree. So I just kind of found that funny that suddenly, you know, it's developed this cult following. We're still talking about it 40 years later. It's still considered, you know, one of those kind of underground classics that people didn't expect, or, you know,
but
it wasn't a hit.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but if you look up into his career, it's almost like every movie he does is destined for cult following only. He makes he has nothing but flops under his belt, with the exception of Halloween and I don't know which other ones. But most of the movies that he puts out in live release, they flop.
Yeah.
So when they hit the home video market, you know, people, you know, they need something odd and bizarre to watch late at night. And, so, back in the day, you go to the mom-and-pop store, you see a cool-looking VHS movie, and you don't even, well, some people don't even think of the name until, you know, after a while, John Carpenter's name became more recognizable to everybody else. But his movies just were so bizarre that they weren't acceptable in wide release until they hit the home video market, and people took the chance with them. And maybe in most cases, some people weren't exactly sober, but It's just the fact that he's a cult director.
Mm-hmm.
You're never going to see John Carpenter direct a comic book movie unless it's some kind of bizarre, you know, underground comic book. So that's the genius of John Carpenter, is that even though he hasn't directed a movie in quite some time, back then, back when he was directing consistently, you have to give him respect for not giving a shit. He mm-hmm. just did what he wanted to do, and he knew that at least a handful of people were going to talk about it someday.
Yeah, I agree, and actually, I think he left pretty much the filmmaking because he got so frustrated with it after making The Ward. I think he's like, I'm done with this business, and now he's got a pretty fluid career as a musician now. So we're going to wrap it up here for the night. I hope you got a little insight on Assault on Precinct 13 and hopefully made you to go out and seek it in any form you can. There's some great different versions out there. We were talking about it before. Shout Factory's got a great, I think, Blu-ray, is it now, out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really good. It's really good, actually. It's really mm-hmm. good. Even though Carpenter's commentary isn't quite as good as it normally is on that one, it's a great release.
Best commentary I've heard so far in a while, and I usually don't watch too much commentary, was on, I think it was the Big Trouble in Little China Blu-ray,
where
two-thirds of it is him and Kurt Russell catching up on their lives and not even really talking about the film.
It's like, all their commentaries are that way.
It's hilarious.
They have four commentaries, and all they do is talk about their kids.
I love it because I popped it in for Big Trouble Little China, and I'm like sitting going, okay, we're gonna get some great insight in that. And they start off with a few details, and then he's like, "Oh, how you been, Kurt?" Oh, I'm okay. I'm just like, wait, what? And the film's playing, and he'll interject something occasionally, or Russell will. Then they go back to, hey, well, my kid's playing ball now, and I'm just. So John Carpenter is definitely a unique director, and you can say yes, he's a cult director, but he wears it proudly, I think, and he got frustrated with the Hollywood machine, and I think if we look at modern films, we can kind of see why he did that. So. We're going to wrap it up here for the night, though. We'll do our normal Pimp Your Stuff section here real quick. So, Cole, go ahead. Where can they find you at, sir?
Man, right now I'm on Facebook, Shadows and Lovers Productions. Well, I'm finishing this movie in a few hours called The Last Great Horror Movie. It's not perfect, but it's extremely independent and extremely intense. And seek it out if you're looking for something that is outside of the machine, because there's nothing industrial about this. Thanks for having me tonight, man. This is a fun conversation.
You bet. Glad you can make it. And Gabe, where can they find your stuff at, sir?
I just want to briefly mention, because we didn't mention him.
Oh, sure.
Tony Ward, the guy, best known, is it Tony Ward? Tony Burton,
mm-hmm.
The guy who's mostly known for the Rocky movies and as Duke, he was in this movie. He was great. He was the inmate along with Napoleon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he was good.
Yeah, he was great. I loved how he had a silencer on his revolver. He didn't realize that he was shooting an empty gun half the night.
He gets one of the best lines too, where he says, "I've got a plan," and they're like, "What's your plan?" And I got my plan: save ass, which
yes.
means I'm gonna run out that window and haul ass to the border.
I love that guy. As for myself, my YouTube channel is Stuffed Burrito Entertainment. Follow me on Twitter at Stuck Burrito E Entertainment, didn't fit in the name. And also check out We Live Film on YouTube. I do a lot of collab reviews there, and you can see me on the weekly podcast when I'm there. And also check out WeLiveEntertainment.com, where I usually do a lot of written content. So there you go. Thank you once again for having me.
We're glad to have you on there, Gabe. And Glenn, go ahead. You've got a little bit of a change, I think, of where people can follow you.
Yes, you can now find me on YouTube with Guy in a Bunker Productions, or follow me on Twitter, Guy in a Bunker.
Awesome. So is that a new YouTube channel?
Is that the new name?
That's the new name.
Nice.
Wow. So he put some clothes on.
Yes, it is. It is more search friendly. If you type a search, that was not a good thing. So
I will update the link then on my Facebook page as well, on the website, I should say, so you can go to the proper link for that. Great to have you on here as always, Glenn. And Scott, how about you? Where can they find you?
You can catch me at moviocrity.com. Finally getting some updates. I just premiered a brand new web series today called Reaction Shots. It's basically a really short and sweet reviews with still photos and stuff so that I can just kind of like rattle these things off really quick and stuff and keep content flowing even while I'm working on the bigger stuff. That's moviocrity.com. You can catch Reaction Shots on YouTube, and my web series Moviocrity, all about exploitation cinema, is oh my god, I talked too fast there. It is on vimeo.com/channels/moviocrity.
Hey, Scott, not to interrupt. Can we subscribe to your Vimeo channel? I don't know anything about Vimeo.
That is a fantastic question. Yes, you can.
Awesome. No, I want to.
I'm looking right here.
I've been subscribing to Mott's YouTube and you know, Glenn's YouTube and everybody's YouTube, but you're not there, correct?
No, I'm on YouTube. On YouTube. You can catch me at, it's at Moviocrity on YouTube as well, because I've got all my stuff, but all the Reaction Shots episodes are going to be there. But all of the Moviocrity episodes are on are pretty much on Vimeo.
Because
you can subscribe to it. I just don't see where, but you can.
there's a follow. You can follow the Vimeo channel of the individual person. I believe it's a follow, kind of like a subscribe. But check out all of these fine folks' information. I have links on the specialmarkproductions.com where you can find all of my stuff, as well as links to all of these lovely individuals. That's where you can find the podcast archive, the Spoiler Room archive. You can also check the interviews out, which I just finished up an interview with the producer and the director of the film that they've got a Kickstarter out. They're trying to get it up and going. Manos Return, the direct sequel to Manos, Hands of Fate. Yay. And it is being produced by the actress who played the little girl in the original Manos, and it is being directed by one Tanya Atomic, who's been on a few of our shows in the past. So check it out at manosreturns.com. Check out our interview as well as our archive and stuff I do at specialmarkproductions.com. I hope you found this entertaining. We've got a number of big 4-0 episodes throughout the year coming at you, and stay tuned, because next week we've got Deadpool that we're going to talk about in depth. So stay tuned for that. We appreciate you as always on iTunes. If you're listening to us, please rate us and comment. That really helps us out there. I thank you for your support. And remember, in the spoiler room, the conversation is fresh, but we do spoil the movies. Now it's time to enact Plan Save Ass.